KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump is invoking a law last used to create Japanese internment camps to deport hundreds of people without court hearings. We talked to a lawyer suing to block the administration. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration also says it's investigating dozens of colleges, accusing them of anti-Semitism and race-based policies. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Schools say they are overwhelmed by what they call attacks on academic freedom. Also, can France use its nuclear weapons to deter Russian aggression against Europe? And how technology has upended the music industry over the last quarter century? It's Monday, March 17th. On this day in 1992, white South Africans overwhelmingly voted to end decades of apartheid. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Strong storms in the central and southeastern U.S. are blamed for at least 39 deaths over the weekend. People were killed in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama. From Troy Public Radio, Emily Mosier reports on what people in southern Alabama experienced.
People in Troy, Alabama, who once considered themselves living in the woods, say that has changed after a tornado toppled hundreds of trees around their homes. Don Wambles with the Alabama Disaster Relief Association has rushed to many scenes of destruction to provide aid. But he breaks down when talking about the tornado in his own neighborhood.
You see the damage, the destruction to people's lives, and the fact that they're just absolutely overwhelmed by the damage.
Alabama Governor Kay Ivey has expressed condolences to those across the state who have experienced property damage and loss of life. For NPR News, I'm Emily Mosier in Troy, Alabama.
President Trump says he will speak with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, tomorrow. The Trump administration continues to pursue a ceasefire deal in Ukraine. Trump has said he's cautiously optimistic about a peace deal. NPR's Charles Maines reports that's despite a list of concerns that Putin raised about the ceasefire plan.
President Putin is on record saying he supports Trump's ceasefire proposal in principle, but the Kremlin leader also laid out a laundry list of issues that he insists require further discussions. That includes how to keep Ukraine from using the ceasefire to rearm, who would monitor the agreement, and what penalties might exist for violating its terms. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accuses Russia of stalling for time to improve its battlefield position. Meanwhile, Moscow continues to demand what a senior Russian foreign ministry official called ironclad security guarantees, excluding Ukraine from NATO membership, and ruled out NATO-aligned European peacekeepers monitoring any ceasefire, if and when it comes. Charles Maines, NPR News.
A federal judge in Boston has set a hearing this morning to review the deportation of a doctor from Lebanon. NPR's Tovia Smith reports. The judge says he has received serious allegations that the Trump administration disobeyed his court order not to deport the doctor who was legally working in the U.S.
Rasha Alloway, a kidney transplant doctor at a Brown University-affiliated medical group, was here on an H-1B visa. That's the one meant for highly specialized workers. And she went to visit family in Lebanon. And when she returned, she was detained for 36 hours at Boston's Logan Airport. Apparently, even her lawyers made a frantic call to the airport control tower trying to stop the plane she was on. But they say officials, quote, willfully disobeyed the judge's order and sent her back anyway.
NPR's Tovia Smith reporting. On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, Dow futures are down by about 160 points. You're listening to NPR News. President Trump claims that pardons given by former President Joe Biden are, quote, void. Writing online, Trump claims that's because Biden used an auto pen to sign the pardons. There is no evidence of that. Trump singled out members of the House committee that investigated the January 6th attacks who received preemptive pardons. The Constitution specifically says the president has pardon power, and it does not say that subsequent presidents have the power to revoke these. The Vatican has released a photo of Pope Francis praying in a hospital chapel. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports the 88-year-old pontiff has been hospitalized in Rome for more than a month.
The image published online by the Holy See Press Office shows Francis sitting in a wheelchair inside the hospital's private chapel. The Vatican says Francis, who was wearing a white robe and purple vestment, was praying after having just finished concelebrating Mass Sunday morning. The 88-year-old Pope entered the hospital on February 14th for a case of bronchitis. While there, he developed several other medical issues, including a polymicrobial infection and pneumonia in both lungs. But doctors now say Francis is stable and responding well to his ongoing treatments. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
On this St. Patrick's Day, numerous cities around the country are holding events and parades to celebrate Irish heritage. New York City is holding its parade today. Boston celebrated on Sunday. St. Patrick's Day was originally observed as a religious holiday. The U.S. observes March as Irish American Heritage Month. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we'll hear why a farmer in Peru is suing an energy company in Germany over climate change. But first,
the Trump administration has deported hundreds of people who it accuses of being Venezuelan gang members.
This weekend, they were flown not to Venezuela, but to El Salvador. In an extraordinary move, President Trump relied on a rarely used law from more than 200 years ago to quickly expel them without hearings or due process. A federal judge is trying to stop this.
We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido. So let's start off with what the Trump administration used to justify their actions.
Well, on Saturday, President Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act. It is a law from 1798 that authorizes summarily detaining or deporting citizens of an enemy nation. This is a wartime law. We are not at war with Venezuela, but in his order, Trump described Venezuela's Tren de Aragua prison gang as a force invading the U.S. And hours later, hundreds of immigrants his administration claims are in that gang had been deported to El Salvador. Here's White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt on Fox News.
The president invoked this authority to deport nearly 300 of them who are now in El Salvador, where they will be behind bars where they belong rather than roaming freely in American communities.
El Salvador's president Nayib Bukele said that he would lock them up for a year, and he released photos of shackled men being unloaded from planes and having their heads shaved.
Yeah, the ACLU sued to stop these deportations, and a federal judge agreed to temporarily block them, but what happened?
Yeah, it was an emergency suit from the ACLU on Saturday, and Judge James Boasberg of the Federal District Court in D.C. said that he didn't think the Alien Enemies Act authorized the immediate deportations. He told the government to turn back any planes that might already be in the air, but that didn't happen, and it's not clear if the planes had already landed in El Salvador or if officials chose not to divert them back to the U.S. El Salvador's president, who takes pride in flouting due process in his crime crackdowns, mocked the judge's order on social media, writing, oopsie, too late.
And tell us more about the concerns civil liberties advocates are raising over the president's use of this law.
Well, the Alien Enemies Act has only been used three times before, the last time during World War II when the government used it to detain Japanese, German, and Italian citizens. Legal Learned, the ACLU's attorney in this lawsuit, told NPR Trump is misusing the law.
The Alien Enemies Act cannot be used during peacetime for regular immigration enforcement. Congress was very clear in the statute that it can only be used against a foreign government or foreign nation.
He says the ACLU acted fast because once the U.S. has turned someone over to a foreign government, federal courts lose jurisdiction. A judge can't order El Salvador to send people back.
Now, the people who were deported, who the Trump administration claims are gang members, do we really know if they are Tren de Aragua members?
We don't know who most of them are. The Trump administration hasn't named them, hasn't offered evidence to back up its claim. Since yesterday, some families of men who were in immigration detention in the U.S. have spoken out to say they fear their loved ones may have been in this group and that they are not gang members.
So what happens now?
Well, the Trump administration has appealed the judge's order temporarily blocking deportations under the law. The ACLU says it'll fight this vigorously. They insist there is huge danger in allowing the president to invoke wartime authorities during peacetime, that it sets a dangerous precedent.
All right, that's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Wei.
Now we turn to one of the groups suing the Trump administration over these deportations. Skye Perryman is the president and CEO of Democracy Forward. It describes itself as a national legal organization promoting democracy through litigation. Good morning, Skye, and thanks for joining me in the studio.
And good morning.
So your organization filed the suit alongside the ACLU, and I'd like to just play you President Trump's explanation as to why he believes he can invoke this 18th century wartime law when there's no war.
Well, this is a time of war because Biden allowed millions of people, many of them criminals, many of them at the highest level. They emptied jails out. Other nations emptied their jails into the United States. That's an invasion.
So what's your reaction to that?
Well, this is really such a fundamental moment to have the president of the United States invoking this wartime authority in a time where we are not at war, we are not being invaded, and the president has a number of tools at his disposal for immigration enforcement. But this is a really improper and a great acceleration of his attempt to accelerate power that he doesn't have under our Constitution, and it should really concern every single American, because this is an expansion of presidential power that could essentially say, I mean, these people have now been, removed, or the president is seeking to remove them without any type of due process, and that's against our Constitution, but it's also a threat to everyone.
Now, you're saying he doesn't need to invoke this act in order to remove what they're saying are dangerous individuals?
Well, I think it's important because a lot of the administration's sort of made for TV moments and talking points are not really, they're not really describing what's happening here. The individuals, as we understand, that they are seeking right now to remove are already in custody in some way, but they're seeking to circumvent the process that we have in our country in order to just expand power and do something with no process at all. So that's highly concerning. We've not ever been in this situation in the country. But yes, obviously, the United States has comprehensive immigration laws with a lot of enforcement powers. But this one is a misuse.
Now, the administration carried out these deportations despite a judge's ruling blocking them. And they said the planes carrying the migrants were already in the air at the time of the ruling, so they didn't have to comply. What do you make of that explanation?
Well, I think, this is the government's positions here, and I heard you all summarize what the El Salvadoran president said, and then, of course, you have the Secretary of State retweeting that yesterday, making light of a court's order. This is not normal, and it's not okay. We filed a paper with the court late last night with the ACLU, of course, raising a number of responses to how the government has been conducting itself in the court hearing, and we're going to work very hard with the court to ensure that the government complies with the order. But we have serious concerns about this compliance because it does look like that they're just operating in the throes, that the rule of law does not apply to them. And it's highly concerning and should be concerning for all Americans.
Now, we've heard Trump advisors, administration officials blaming, in general, activist judges for blocking the president's lawful authority, as they say. And this is, in this case, in other cases, even though these decisions have been made by Republican and Democratic appointed judges. In this case, did the judge overstep, as the White House officials say they did?
Absolutely not. I mean, you see the judge doing exactly what, exactly what we want federal judges to do. In an emergent situation, he looked at the facts, he held a hearing, he heard the government, and he ultimately issued a temporary order. So while the case is pending, this is what it means to live under the rule of law in the country. It should be concerning to everyone that our president doesn't believe that the laws apply to him. And I'll just note that, you know, the majority of Americans, the vast majority of Americans, and the vast majority of actually Republicans, when they're asked, including last month, agree that presidents should follow court orders. And so we believe this is a real crisis point, and we're looking forward to raising these issues before the court.
Skye Perryman of Democracy Forward, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
A groundbreaking court case involving climate kicks off today in Germany. A Peruvian farmer is suing an energy giant in Germany for what he claims is its historic role in accelerating the effects of global warming and contributing to glaciers melting high above his home in the Andes, thousands of miles away. Here's Simeon Tegel reporting from Peru.
Peru is home to 70% of the world's tropical glaciers, but they are disappearing rapidly. Paucarcocha, a lake in the heart of the country's Cordillera Blanca mountain range, is already swollen by Andean meltwater to over 30 times its normal volume. The threat of flooding in the valley below, constant.
Hay mucho miedo porque no la laguna no está más alto.
The fear grows when it rains intensely, just like it has in recent weeks, and the lake rises, says farmer Saul Luciano Yuya. NPR managed to catch up with him in Hamburg.
En zona de riesgo ante un posible aluvión, ¿no? Viven o estarían perjudicados 50,000 personas.
50,000 people living below Paucarcocha, around the town of Huaraz, stand to lose their homes and lives if the lake bursts its banks, Yuya says. Now Yuya is suing German power company RWE over the carbon produced by its coal-fired power stations, which have been belching it into the atmosphere since the 19th century.
We want Saul and the people in Huaraz to live in safety.
Francesca Masha Klein is a lawyer for the environmental nonprofit German Watch, which is supporting Yuya's claim. The landmark civil case, using a property law usually targeted at difficult neighbors, opened in Hamm, in northwestern Germany. Klein says that just by agreeing to hear Yuya's case, the judges have already set a precedent for dozens of other similar lawsuits being brought around the world, including one in Honolulu against Chevron, Exxon, and other oil majors.
No one should fear losing their home due to the climate crisis.
German Watch estimates that RWE has produced nearly 0.5% of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. Klein again.
Fossil companies have known for decades their products caused climate change, but they covered up the science while they made hundreds of billions of profits.
RWE, which has never operated in Peru, denies legal responsibility. It argues climate change is a global issue caused by many contributors. If found liable, the company says, then even ordinary motorists could potentially be sued for their vehicle's carbon footprints. The climate crisis should be resolved by government policy, RWE says, not in court.
Espero que la desglaciación pare.
Yuya just hopes the glaciers stop melting, but he admits that's unlikely. Instead, he says, the focus needs to be on making polluters pay to manage the risks. For NPR News, I'm Simeon Tegel in Lima, Peru.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Clay Risen describes a political movement which destroyed the careers of thousands of teachers, civil servants, and artists whose beliefs or associations were deemed un-American. His book, Red Scare, is about post-World War II America, but he says there's a through line connecting that era to our current political moment. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We are reporting on the first quarter of our century. Those 25 years show how our world has changed and give us clues to where we're going. In today's installment, we consider a quarter century of music. The world has changed even more than it did in the first quarter of the 20th century.
I mean, when you're down and
out. When music like this was popular, jazz and blues spread through technology, flat disc records. Technology from the early 1900s eventually changed the music itself. New, more sensitive microphones made it possible for musicians to sing to their audiences in a more intimate way.
You came to me from out of nowhere.
Bing Crosby rode those innovations far into the century, while jazz and blues inspired music that lasted even longer. In our quarter century, technology again is changing music. In the year 2000, CDs ruled the earth. NSYNC sold 2.4 million copies of No Strings Attached during its first week, and that was a record.
But then piracy happened.
NPR Music's Ann Powers is our guide to this quarter century.
I mean, this was young tech masters figuring out how to share music across the new expanse of cyberspace.
In 2000, internet file sharing was already causing CDs to go.
Bye, 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 bye.
Napster launched about 9 months before that NSYNC album, and others followed. NPR talked with two University of Virginia students back in 2000.
I used to spend a lot of money on CDs and stuff, and now it's just so much easier just going like these Napster things. It takes like 10 seconds per song.
I'm online right now, and there are 259,025 separate songs, all of which are online and accessible by me.
Which meant 259,025 separate songs for which artists and record companies were not being paid.
It was a real shock. I mean, the gates were falling everywhere, and fans were taking control.
Labels were freaking out. Entire record store chains went out of business.
This was as big a change as when the recorded music era began 100 years before. What most of us fans didn't know was what the labels were already planning, right? Which was to figure out a way to monetize and, frankly, corporatize this new Wild West.
First by suing Napster out of existence, and then by supporting music streaming. Spotify came out of Europe in 2006, reaching the U.S. in 2011.
Daniel Ek, the founder of Spotify, he's Swedish. Sweden was like the wildest Wild West for piracy.
Who knew?
Absolutely. And this was supposed to be like, hey, let's all put our stuff on the same platform, make it easy for fans. And as they were able to make these deals with the labels, they had the music everyone wanted.
For those who don't use it, Spotify is like a personalized radio. The record labels get paid, and you pick the music. Eventually, you pick different music because the tech makes it possible. I'm thinking about the way that I use my phone for music. I'll get a song in my head and I'll listen to it 50 times.
Right.
No problem. I may also go, an old song comes into my head, Snowbird.
Yes.
Spread your tiny wings and fly away.
And take the snow back with you wherever it came from on that day.
Anne Murray, right?
Yeah, well, at first I didn't know the name, but I found the song. I found that was the artist that had the hit. And then I start finding all the other versions of this song.
Right.
Elvis Presley sang that song.
The breeze along the river seems to say.
Loretta Lynn.
That he'll only break my heart again should I decide to stay.
I'll end up having this experience of music that I had no idea I was looking for until I started looking for it.
Well, this is why we love streaming, frankly. It feels so natural. It feels organic. It moves at the speed of thought. But there are consequences. There's been very major consequences for artists. The rise of streaming has really changed the economics of the music industry in ways that have not benefited most artists.
Well, let me understand that, because I would think that the person who's not super famous would benefit from streaming, because whatever their audience is, they can maximize it through streaming. If there's only 10,000 people in the world who might like their music, they can find it on streaming. Why isn't that not good for them?
Well, this is the paradox, right? We live in a time when it is far easier to become a, I guess, quote unquote, professional musician, or become a musician with the public, let's say, than ever before. But fewer and fewer people can sustain themselves.
Wow.
Because music has been devalued, frankly. If everything feels free, we expect things to be free. When the major labels negotiated deals with the platforms, the artist was left out in the cold.
And if technology made it hard to succeed, it also determined who did succeed. Algorithms and playlists increasingly choose music for people who stream it, and they often create hits.
So a song like Despacito or Old Town Road by Lil Nas X, which is a total streaming phenomenon, you know, it was on so many playlists that it just never went away.
Is it possible we're heading to that moment when people turn on a particular stream that's delivered to them by algorithm, and the algorithm begins sending them reasonably serviceable, good enough music that's produced by AI?
Yes.
And no human beings have been involved in it at all.
It's already happening.
This is a Vocaloid, a voice entirely AI generated. She's got a name, Hatsune Miku. You can see a picture of her rendered as an anime character, but she doesn't exist, singing without the singer. One of my kids listens.
People are so adaptable, just as no one thought at the dawn of the recording industry that, you know, listening to a voice that was pressed onto a slab of wax could be as good as hearing someone sing in person or play the piano in person. Look how we adapted to that. Bing Crosby got his mouth near a microphone and the world swooned. So this is what we do. We adapt to technology.
Ann Powers has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
We're telling the history of the first quarter of our century. We've so far heard of space travel and music, and we have more to come. This is NPR News.
Wouldn't it be nice if AI could actually do things for us?
Even just to do very basic things, like being able to make a sandwich or being able to clean a kitchen.
Some researchers are now putting AI into robots. Don't worry, they're not going to take over the world yet.
We can just throw some water on them, and in most cases they don't work anyway, so.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More on how researchers are applying AI to robotics on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Trump administration has deported more than 200 alleged gang members from the U.S. to El Salvador. They were flown out of the U.S. under an 18th century wartime law. Secretary of State Marco Rubio described them as violent criminals. A federal judge blocked the flights, but they still landed in El Salvador. NPR's Eder Peralta has more.
The government of El Salvador released videos showing U.S. Border Patrol handing over dozens of men. Then the videos show the men in chains being escorted by armed guards. The videos show the men being shaved and then taken to El Salvador's maximum security prison. Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele said 238 of them were members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, and another 23 were Salvadoran gang members. The U.S., he said, would pay a, quote, very low fee to keep them in prison for a year. A spokeswoman for the presidency told NPR they did not yet know whether these detainees had been convicted in the United States. Eder Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
President Trump says he plans to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin tomorrow about a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire in Ukraine. Speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One yesterday, Trump said he believes there's a very good chance Putin will agree to the temporary halt in fighting. This is NPR News. Police in North Macedonia are holding at least 15 people in connection with a deadly nightclub fire. It broke out early yesterday at Club Pulse in the east of the country, killing 59 people and injuring more than 100 others. Authorities say the injured suffered smoke inhalation and burns. Some were trampled trying to get through the building's lone exit. Police say the fire was sparked by pyrotechnics set off during a live concert. The U.S. Census Bureau's internal watchdog says the agency hasn't been recruiting or retaining enough interviewers for key national surveys. Here's NPR's Hansi Lo Wong.
The economic indicators and other statistics the Census Bureau produces rely on survey responses that are often collected in person or over the phone by field representatives. A review by the Commerce Department Inspector General's office has found that the Census Bureau has not met its staffing goal for those interviewers, including for the current population survey that produces the monthly jobs report. Many field representatives don't stay in their jobs for long, the Inspector General's office found, in part because the pay is often relatively low and it can be difficult to persuade people to participate in a government survey. The Inspector General's report recommends that a plan for addressing staffing gaps be developed by the Census Bureau's director. President Trump has not yet named a nominee to fill that position. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News, Washington.
Fashion retailer Forever 21 says it's filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. It first did so in 2019. I'm Dave Mattingly.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faldin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The Trump administration is investigating dozens of colleges and universities, accusing some of using race-based programs and others of failing to rein in anti-Semitism. Columbia University has perhaps faced the most scrutiny. The administration sent a letter requesting unprecedented control at the university over things like discipline policies and academic programs. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny is here to explain. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so let's start with this letter that the Trump administration sent to Columbia University. What was in it? So the letter demands that the university make several dramatic changes, including implementing stricter student discipline policies like expulsion and multi-year suspension, reimagining admissions. And this is the one that put a lot of free speech scholars really on alert. It said they wanted to place its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies department under, quote, academic receivership for a minimum of 5 years. Now, the letter doesn't explain why, and a lot of these bullet points are very vague. But all of these were described in the letter as conditions for receiving federal funding and necessary for reissuing the $400 million in federal grants that the administration canceled over allegations that Columbia had failed to police anti-Semitism on campus.
And what's been the reaction?
A Columbia University spokesman said in an email to NPR that school officials were reviewing the letter. They said they're, quote, committed to advancing the school's mission, supporting students, and addressing all forms of discrimination and hatred on campus. I talked about the federal government weighing in on this level with Ted Mitchell, the president of the American Council on Education, which represents most colleges in the U.S.
Without the independence to be able to create and produce a wide-ranging academic program, we lose academic freedom. We lose the ability to challenge some of the most fundamental shibboleths in society.
And Layla, it's worth noting that the federal government has almost never used its authority to cut off money from schools and colleges.
And it's not just Columbia, right?
That's right. Trump has said colleges that don't get in line with his administration's priorities, like eliminating research related to being transgender or having diversity and inclusion programs, they may also lose federal funding. On Friday, his administration announced investigations into 52 universities as part of this DEI crackdown. The majority of those colleges, which include schools like the University of Kansas and the University of Utah, they partnered with a small nonprofit called the PhD Project that helps students from underrepresented groups earn doctoral degrees in business. The Education Department alleges the program limits eligibility based on race, and so colleges involved are engaging in, quote, race exclusionary practices.
So how are universities handling all this?
So Lynn Pascarella, the president of the American Association of Colleges and Universities, has been talking to administrators the last few days.
They're feeling beleaguered. They're feeling overwhelmed. They feel like they are being coerced into making decisions they believe are unethical, but feel they have no choice. So there's a deep sense of moral distress.
You know, this week, college leaders are going program by program to make sure they're abiding by the administration's rules and guidance. And honestly, Layla, they're watching what's happening at Columbia, and they're worried they may be next.
That's Alyssa Nadworny. Thanks for this, Lalissa.
You bet.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin says he supports a 30-day ceasefire with Ukraine in theory, but he adds that Ukraine would need to accept further conditions before a deal could be finalized. Now, in the interim, European leaders are discussing ways to discourage future Russian aggression. French President Emmanuel Macron has proposed using France's nuclear capabilities as a deterrent to Russian threats. But what does nuclear deterrence look like in Europe if NATO is unsure if the U.S. will be a committed partner? Joining us now is Paul Cormery. He's an analyst for the think tank, the RAND Corporation. He focuses on NATO and European defense policy. So, Paul, can France really provide security for the entire European continent? I mean, does it have the resources for this?
So it's important to be specific with what Macron actually proposed. It is opening the debate, asking whether or not France can actually fill this role and asking both at home and also abroad about what that could look like. So there's a whole debate here to be held.
Yeah. Macron has been wondering about this for a few years now, kind of throwing it out there. It's like, okay, can we do this kind of thing? But isn't there a much more deeper sense of urgency now, considering what we've heard out of the Trump administration and what they want the U.S.'s role in NATO to be?
There's definitely a sense of urgency because of the fact that European leaders are now welcoming those initiatives. Thinking here, of course, of Poland, but also Friedrich Merz of Germany, who's made this grand welcome of more French assertiveness. And it's important to note that France is not part of the nuclear planning group that is inside of NATO. So as a result, the French nuclear world has always been a bit more secluded from those discussions with European partners.
Yeah. How concerned are you that any of this, say it does move forward, any of this could lead to an escalation in the number of nuclear weapons in Europe, especially if Europe no longer considers America a reliable ally?
Well, a lot of European countries have negative attitudes towards the nuclear weapons. There's multiple countries that know that they cannot politically envision any nuclear arsenal as a consequence. Say the United States does what France did in the 60s of leaving the integrated command of NATO, that would certainly affect many European countries who feel like they need foreign troops in their territory in order to reassure themselves from any Russian incursion. That will affect their perception of security on the continent, definitely.
Now, Paul, I could hear the Trump administration make an argument that, hey, it's good to see Europe taking a lot more responsibility for its own security. What do you say to that?
Conventionally speaking, yes, that would be great. If it's nuclear arsenal that actually becomes a priority for European countries, that's bad, because nuclear winter, radioactivity, all of the adverse effects from the employment of a nuclear bomb, those don't stop at the border or stop at the ocean. They affect everyone. So that will have important implications for U.S. security as well.
So is all this just maybe an opening debate? Or, I mean, is France really going to move its arsenal, you think?
Well, that's the debate. And France has made it very clear through all of its presidents that its nuclear weapons was always defending its neighbors. So it's something that's been miscategorized as an opening of its nuclear umbrella since 2020, his very first keynote speech on the topic. But in reality, that has always been in discussion when it comes to the French role in nuclear weapons in Europe.
That's Paul Cormery. He's an analyst with the RAND Corporation. Paul, thanks.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Some experts worry the Trump administration is weakening cyber operations against Russia by laying off federal workers and warming up to Vladimir Putin. Next time here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. The state flag of Illinois doesn't seem all that boring. It's got an eagle holding a red, white, and blue shield, but there are some critics who wanted something more creative than just the state seal on a white background. So the state put it to a vote with 13 choices, a few with Abe Lincoln's silhouette, another with a sun rising over the prairie. Legislators have the final say, but the resounding winner this month from the public, the original. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Managing screen time for kids, one of the biggest issues that defines modern parenthood. Teenagers who often do not want to be managed present an extra set of challenges. Well, the American Psychological Association now has a new toolkit to help parents. And NPR's Katie Riddle is here to tell us all about it. Screens and teens, why is this so hard?
Well, you know, as I was reporting this, I started thinking of it like nutrition. You know, like we all broadly know what we need to do, avoid ultra-processed foods and sugar, eat plants, etc. And yet, for many of us, it's still an ongoing struggle. And for screens, you don't want your kid on too long. Anyone who's seen the internet knows there's some really concerning content that you don't want your kid seeing. Here's a mom I talked to named Lauren Salem. She has four kids spanning the tween and teenage years, so she's a real pro. And she was the first one to tell me she does not have all the answers.
There's a lot of big picture guidance, but really there's a disconnect between I get what I'm supposed to do, I get what we're supposed to be aware of, but how do we actually incorporate it in our life, in our family?
Parents are really yearning for guidance.
And that's what you're here for, loaded down with all the answers.
I wish, since I also have a couple of adolescents at home. To be clear, there's no panacea for handling this, but the researchers who worked on this new guide do have some helpful strategies for parents. Here's Mitch Prinstein. He's the APA's chief science officer.
We really want parents to feel like, rather than throw up their hands and feel like it's totally impossible to monitor everything, maybe to give them some tools so they have a sense of how they can talk with their kids about what they're watching.
That's one of the things that Prinstein and his colleagues keep coming back to. Talk with your kids about what they're watching. So, for example, influencers are big now. Lots of teens watch them. You can find an influencer on any subject, style, sports, makeup, romance novels. Some of them can be fun and harmless, but others can contain hostile language or negative social behaviors, even promote substance abuse or self-harm. Teens and tweens are really figuring out who they are, and they're especially susceptible to social messaging. So it's important to know with some specificity what your kids are watching.
Yeah, the problem is, though, I mean, you can't sit with your kid the entire time they're on a screen.
Right. I mean, how would you ever get dinner cooked?
Yeah.
Now, if your teen is looking at screens constantly, you can encourage them to take breaks. But the end goal is to help your child build critical thinking skills so that they are able to bring a more discerning lens to content. For example, one suggestion, have open-ended conversations about how advertising works on apps and digital platforms, including how ads are targeted based on viewing habits. Another example, teens really don't like to be manipulated, so help them to identify sponsored content, even when it's subtly integrated into videos. The most important thing is to stay engaged. Sometimes that might look like just saying, I don't know how much screen time you should be watching every day. What do you think? Or sharing with them the kind of things you're struggling with. Screens are not going away, so the more you can engage with them in a productive way, the better.
That's NPR's Katie Riddle. And now if you're interested in the toolkit, you can find a link to it at npr.org. Katie, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Egyptian and Qatari mediators are trying to negotiate a new Israel-Hamas ceasefire deal to release more hostages being held in Gaza. But the efforts are stuck at the same stumbling block that has stood in the way for a long time: how to reach a permanent end of the conflict. President Trump's Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, was in the region last week trying to reach a breakthrough. He told CNN on Sunday that Hamas should take note of U.S. strikes Saturday on Houthi targets in Yemen.
What happened with the Houthis yesterday? What happened with our strike ought to inform as to where we stand with regard to terrorism and our tolerance level for terrorist actions. I would encourage Hamas to get much more sensible than how they have been.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv and has more on what's happening. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So help us understand the main sticking points right now that are complicating efforts to get Israel and Hamas to agree to reach a new ceasefire deal.
Well, you know, the sides have already completed phase one of their ceasefire, which was an exchange of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. But that was only supposed to be an opening bid that would lead to phase two of the ceasefire deal, which would include moves to reach a permanent end of the war. Mm-hmm. But Israel does not want to end the war while Hamas is still ruling Gaza, and so it has refused to begin negotiating phase two of the deal. And instead, it wants a new deal. It wants more hostages released, and then it says it will talk about the rest. Hamas says, well, the hostages are its card to ensuring the permanent end of the war. So it says it won't keep giving up hostages without a commitment to end the war. And that's where things are stuck.
Okay, so how are mediators going to resolve these differences?
Well, our colleague NPR's Ayab Batraoui in Dubai spoke with an Egyptian official who is close to the talks and who gave details about what mediators are trying to do to reach an agreement. And he said that this is the kind of deal they're trying to reach. That first, Hamas would release Idan Alexander. He is a living Israeli-American hostage in Gaza. And that Hamas would also release the bodies of four American hostages as a starting point. That's something that the U.S. had been demanding in secret direct talks that they were holding with Hamas recently. And it's something Hamas has agreed to also. And then the mediators are hoping for a 50-day ceasefire extension. And by the end of that period, 11 living hostages, so that's about half of the living hostages still in Gaza, would be released, along with a group of bodies of dead hostages. And negotiations on a permanent end of the conflict would begin right away. They would also have to work out an Israeli troop withdrawal from the Gaza border with Egypt. That's something Israel has been publicly refusing. All these details are still in flux because the sides really still are stuck.
Okay, so we heard Steve Witkoff talk about the U.S. strikes on the Houthis in Yemen, and now there's this new development. Prime Minister Netanyahu says he will fire his domestic security chief. How did those factors play a role here?
Yeah, the Houthis in Yemen are backed by Iran. They have been supporting Hamas throughout the war. They've been disrupting international shipping routes and firing at Israel since the start of the Israel-Hamas conflict. The Houthis said that they responded to the U.S. strikes this weekend by targeting a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Red Sea. Now, U.S. officials have told Reuters that U.S. fighter jets shot down Houthi drones before they got close to the U.S. warship. It's unclear if Trump is going to press on with more U.S. strikes on Houthi targets in Yemen, but Steve Witkoff saying that Hamas should pay attention to this. We do know that Israel is preparing plans in case they say they need to return to war in Gaza. So that is a veiled threat to Hamas. And the strikes on the Houthis show that there is a wider regional dimension of this conflict, way beyond the borders of Gaza and Israel. And there's also this new political firestorm now in Israel that you mentioned. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to fire his Shin Bet domestic intelligence chief. He says he's lost trust in him. This was one of the main security chiefs who had been pushing for Israel to prioritize the release of hostages from Gaza, which is something that Netanyahu and his far-right coalition have been resistant to. This would be the third top security chief to leave his post in recent weeks, and the attempt to fire him will be major headlines in Israel for days to come and will distract from and even perhaps disrupt efforts to reach a new hostage release deal.
NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you, Daniel, for your reporting.
You're welcome, Leila.
Hey, Leila, got a dog?
No, scared of dogs. You?
No, they're scared of me. but we know of dogs in the NPR family who enjoy their screen time. One editor's dog, Rico, the Wonder Pup, was soothed by TV game shows.
So what do our canine companions see when they look at a TV screen? And can they get the same engagement from what entertains us?
Scientists in Wisconsin have been looking for those answers.
You know, I'm a massive geek about dog behavior. I have my own dog, and he becomes the sort of pilot project for all sorts of thinkings and ideas.
Freya Moat teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I'm a veterinary ophthalmologist by trade, so I do see clinical patients with eye problems, anything except humans.
Moat and her team surveyed more than 1,200 dog owners and found, maybe no big surprise, that dogs respond most to on-screen images of animals, especially other dogs.
And about a week ago, the New York Times reported that one movie in particular seems to fascinate our four-legged friends.
Now that's from the Latvian film Flow, which won the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. There's no dialogue in the movie. It follows the journey of a black cat, a capybara, a dog, a lemur, and a secretary bird as they try to survive a flood in a pretty barren world.
And a quick search online turns up viral videos of cats and dogs fixating on Flow. Ears perked up, eyes locked on screen. One of our Morning Edition producers says she streamed the film at home and had never seen her dog more focused on the TV. Scientist Freya Moat says it's an intriguing mix.
There are some natural sounds, there are some soothing musics, there's a lot of really beautiful colors that are used in the movie by the looks of things. So the cat is black and it's on this sort of colorful background. And if I think about how dogs see, you know, using their color vision, I think that exact contrast would be very visible to a dog.
And why is this work important?
People laugh when I say I do this research, but then it gets people thinking because it makes them realize that there's a lot more than just showing dogs TV. You know, it's actually the animal some people spend the most time with, you know, so I think it's really meaningful to people. It's also very gentle and enjoyable content. So I think we all need a bit more tonic for the soul right now.
I guess we're all trying to balance big news stories with gentle and enjoyable content. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
Woof! And I'm A. Martinez.
Oh my gosh.
Hey.